Well, hello everyone and welcome to this week's show. I'm your host, Lisa Anderson. First of all, I have to apologize a little bit for the voice. I am sick. I am going to the doctor later today, so I will probably only get Martha sick. She's the one in my closest proximity here at the table, so she'll be down. She'll be down for no more than 2 weeks, I'm sure. We'll see how that goes. But no, I'm going to go with the doctor. But first, the Boundless Show, because it must go on. All right. Later on, we have Candace here to talk about she's addressing a poor girl, bless her heart, who says she's tried everything she really feels she has, and you know, still isn't dating. And so Candace is going to give some advice and some encouragement on that front. And then our culture segment, I talked to Elizabeth Brown. She's the author of Working Successfully with Screwed Up People. That may not apply to you. It certainly doesn't apply to me, but we all work with those type of people, okay? Well, not you, Martha, either. So,
does it apply to me?
It's those other. No, it doesn't apply to you. Whatever. Well, you know those people that are kind of like in our proximity, like the ones that are on the table.
Yeah, like.
Yeah. We'll talk about them later. But she is here. Really some fun insights from her about that. But here we are for the round table. We've got a great group of usual suspects here. Andrew. Hey, Andrew.
Hey.
Good to have you.
It's good to be back at
podcast. I see you still have the beard.
I do. It's giving me strength.
Does that go off in spring or what? Is there a timeline for it or what?
No. Sometimes I just get inspired to let it grow out.
Okay.
And but then I get tired of it and I'll shave it.
Okay. All right.
I thought you were going to be in a passion play or something.
Oh,
yeah.
No.
Oh, nice.
No, but there was one time when I grew a beard and I came home. And my brother, like there was a whole group of my family there. My brother shouted across the room, "Hey, look, it's Jesus."
Hmm.
And I went upstairs and shaved. I was like,
maybe they were just talking about your character.
Yeah, I doubt it.
Oh, okay.
It's my brother. He knows me.
Oh, okay. All right. Chelsea is here. Hey, Chelsea.
Hello. Good to be back.
Great to have you. You do not have a beard.
No, I do not. I shaved it this morning.
Okay. So. It's good. Looking very smooth over there. Okay, well, good thing that later on in the culture we're talking about working, people that you work with. Some of the people you work with are also your friends. But right now we are going to talk about friendships and basically breaking up with people in friendships. Can you do it? Should you do it? Is there ever a time to do it? And if so, how do you do it well? So, you know, there's a song that says breaking up is hard to do. I would say that with friendships, that's probably especially true. Because really, I mean, should you leave your friends? That's pretty rude. You know, I think that there's a lot of, it's weird. I think there are a lot of like biblical contradictions here. Okay. Because
yeah.
You think of, you know, we're called to bear one another's burdens. Iron sharpens iron. But then we're also told that bad company corrupts good character.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're told that there are different seasons. The Bible illustrates different seasons of ministry and of life and stuff. And sometimes you have to move on. But do we know and are we discerning enough to know when that is? So I want to just let you guys jump right in and talk about, you know, okay, obviously we asked you to be part of this panel. What came to mind? What was your first thought is how this applies to you or kind of where you've been in this?
Well, I definitely think that I've bared kind of the crux of this where it's, because you always think, I think sometimes there are friendships where they were kind of thinking it in terms of evangelistically or discipleship oriented, where it's like, I'm in this friendship and I'm trying to encourage this person to grow. And that it's not all like everything you do or everything you say isn't like geared that way. But then there's also times where you start to notice, man, certain friends pull me down. And it's either in the conversation or the kind of the, you know, I've had friends where it's like just always bathroom humor. And it just seemed like, okay, I am really tired of just all these jokes, you know, especially if they like are demeaning to people. And so it is kind of this like, okay, what am I supposed to do? Am I just supposed to tolerate that and hope to continue to build them up? And I think that we should probably have tiers in our lives of how close we allow people to be. And so that there are some people that I would call a general friend that I'm interacting with. I see them at parties, I'm doing life with them and they're there. But then there's also people that I would call my inner circle, people that I let into my heart and let into my life a little bit more. And that's where I'm going to be discerning who I'm going to let really close to me, like who I'm going to share deep things with or, you know, go deeper with or live more intentionally with. And so that's how I kind of bear that dichotomy. But I don't know if that's the right way to do it.
Well, that's true. I mean, it's interesting because I just came off of Beth Moore's David study a couple months ago. And one of her lessons talked about that, about those tears. And she used it in relation to how Jesus Christ related to people. And he had, there was the 72, you know, and then there were the 12. And then out of the 12, there were the three that he was really intimate with. And then the one, which was the Father, and how really we can pattern, you know, and the different levels of intimacy and what you share and what you, you know, expose yourself to and stuff. So that's good. Good analogy.
I think I used to be very unaware of the way people impacted me and affected me. So like in college, having a lot of different friends, a lot of different groups, and just being extremely candid with everyone, open with everyone. And just recently actually noticing that impact that people have on my attitude. And I'll even come home from work or something one day and my husband will be like, you talked to this person after work, didn't you? Because it just, it might make me more dramatic in the way I approach things or gossipy, and I'll have all these other things to say. And so really just wrestling through what does that look like and how does that impact him and our marriage in the way that I communicate with him after work or on a Saturday if I talk to some friends or something like that. And so kind of like what Andrew said of who are those people that you're really going to invest a lot of time in, and if they're negatively impacting you and causing you to, I don't know, talk poorly of others, is that really someone that you want to spend a lot of time with? And just because I like to be really nice and social and be friends with everybody, even just recently I had to make a choice to not do something with some friends because it was like, man, I don't know. I don't know if I want to spend all evening talking like that or being so pessimistic. Mm-hmm. And like just the way that they talk and conversate, it was just, I don't think I want to do that this weekend. And so making those decisions is hard, especially when you're trying to make new friends and really get to know people. But I really think I've been learning too how to see myself and in, you know, we are the righteousness of Christ. And so if that's true, like what other people say about me shouldn't necessarily impact me. So I used to try to impress people a lot. And now it's like, you know, if I'm just myself, then true friends will really come my way. And I don't have to fight for them or search for them. And it used to be kind of this like trying to impress people and really understanding who I am in Christ, knowing that I don't have to do that necessarily. You know, if I really am who God created me to be, then the right people will come my way. So I guess that's maybe two different things, but it's really helped me discern who do I want to be, and if I am that person, well, the right people, I'll be friends with them and they'll be attracted to me.
Well, I really like what you said about friends having an impact on your attitude and what you talk about and what you think about. Because when we were first discussing this topic, I was thinking, I don't have any friends that are forcing me to go to R-rated movies or friends that are telling me I should shoplift or, I mean, thinking of those big things.
That is so good, Martha. Yeah. That would be a problem.
Yeah, for the day. Yeah.
Well, I guess that's high school. Maybe I'm thinking way back then of how teenagers struggle with this issue, but it can be even those subtle ways of an attitude.
Well, I didn't even notice it until someone, you know, my husband pointed it out. He was like, I can tell when you spend time with certain people because of the way that you act.
Yeah. Well, that brings up a good question, because I think we all come, I mean, maybe we have different styles of gathering friends or of choosing friends. And I think there are some that kind of like organically let friendships develop and kind of just stage of life, people stick to you or whatever. And then there are people I know that will identify a person and they will say, I like that person, I admire them, I'm going to be their friend. And they very intentionally like pursue that person. Where would you say you guys fall in that? And does your current slate of friends reflect that?
I think I'm pretty intentional of, I've noticed people like in my small group before and be like, I am going to ask her to go out for lunch sometime coming up, and I'm going to plan a party and invite my favorite people.
You never invited me to a party.
Sorry, Andrew.
That's cool. Yeah, I mean, I think I'm probably in the balance of those two, because I'm not super intentional. I wish I was more intentional sometimes. Like I recently made a list of people I went to college with that I want to call and catch up with, because I'm not really good about keeping up with friends that live at a distance, live across the country. And so I think a lot of times when I see friendships that I've had, it's kind of like, I don't know how that happened. Like we just met at a party and then boom, we were friends. And it's like, I didn't have to cultivate it as much, but there are times where there've been people who are like, I want to kind of build in this relationship. And usually those are the people that you wouldn't naturally hang out with or are kind of outside your social sphere. And a lot of those are relationships where it's a kind of an iron sharpening iron relationship. There's a gentleman that I get together with probably once a month, and we haven't like officially called it like a mentorship type relationship, but we just get together and just talk about what we're reading and how we're growing. And that's something that I'm like, we're both keeping that going, and it's a good thing, but we haven't like, you know, had to put boundaries on it or say, this is what this is. But we're really just friends getting together and encouraging each other. So
I think, like I said, coming out of college only 2 years ago, having a lot of great friends there, and then moving here, getting married, starting a new life, and trying to keep up those friendships. Like you said, distance friendships are so difficult. Mm-hmm. And finding a way to do that while making new friends and not comparing new friends to old friends. And so I've really had to be more intentional about seeing someone at a small group or at church and be like, man, I want to be that person's friend. Because I think before, like when you're in a setting like college, like it happens so naturally, like the people you're like tend to just come around you. But I think there's a more positive side to getting to choose your friends. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and just like naturally letting it happen.
Yeah. And I think a lot of times today, like today, a lot of single people wrestle with changes of life phase and how it impacts our friendships. You know, like I've had like probably 5 years ago here in the Springs, I had this great network of friends, people that we would spend time together all the time, just hanging out, kind of like, you know, the hit TV show Friends. I mean, we're just always hanging out and it was great. And then a lot of those couple, like a lot of people paired off and got married, and that changed the friendship. And it wasn't, you know, it's not a good or bad thing, but that just that priority, that phase of life changed. And so now there's a few of us that are kind of like, what happened? Like we had this great thing going and then everybody got married. And it's not, I mean, and that was a good thing. I actually did a lot of those weddings, but you know, but I do think sometimes we look around and we're like, hey, what happened? I like had this great thing going and now it like it's changed. And then we're back to square one. It's like, man, I need to go find some new friends, you know?
Or mm-hmm. people move away. I've had so many friends get different jobs and it almost makes you not want to get to know a new person. Yeah. Are you just going to leave me? Because mm-hmm. it's happened a lot in the past few years. Mm-hmm.
Have you guys ever been in a situation where you've consciously made a decision about a friendship, either where it was a conscious decision to end it, to fade it, to transition it, or maybe just situations where like you've made conscious decisions about things you'll attend or ways friendships will play out or just things that you don't want to be a part of that have affected kind of relationally relating to other people?
One of my personal convictions is I don't drink, and it has affected a lot of what I'll do with people. Of, you know, if it's a happy hour mm-hmm. on a Friday after work or something, I'm just not interested. And I've even decided recently that if I see a Facebook invitation that it's like, bring your own beer, bring your own whatever, it kind of gives me a clue of what this party is about. And I know I'm probably not going to enjoy myself. And so mm-hmm. I might as well do something else that evening. Mm-hmm. So it's...
I was very, just to that point, you know, for me, and I grew up like, you know, drinking was totally taboo. And then I've kind of, you know, transitioned into perhaps a bit more grace-filled lens towards that. I don't know, generally. But I was invited to a party once where it was like you showed up and there were just coolers everywhere of liquor. And it was like the whole focus of the party was drinking. And I was like, that is just not okay. And it really bugged me. And I felt like I didn't have a substantive conversation with anyone. It was kind of like the equivalent of, we haven't seen each other in 2 years. Let's get together and watch a movie. You know, it's like, what is the point? You know? So I just thought like, what? Yeah. You know, but yeah, that reminded me of that when you said that, Martha.
Yeah. Because I was surprised by that when I moved to Colorado, because I grew up in the Midwest and things were very, like, basically grew up real conservative on that topic where Christians don't drink. And I came out here.
You've never been to South Dakota, have you?
I haven't. Maybe I driven through, I don't know. But when I moved out here, like, I went to church, met some people at church, and they said, hey, come to this party. And literally got there, and they had these tables of Jello shots. And I was like, oh my gosh, what's going on? And it was a shock to my system. And I've kind of had to just manage that. But I agree with you, Martha, that if I go to a party and I can tell the goal is let's get drunk and then see what happens or have a good time. Mm-hmm. I'm like, no, we can have a good time. Like, I'm a fun guy. I can make fun. You know, I can
Scrabble.
Make
some...
Yeah, there is always Scrabble, you know.
So, yeah. Personal favorite.
Yeah.
It used to be that you just went to church functions and had Jello. Now it's Jello shots. So yeah. It's kind of the morphing.
Yeah, but and I don't think it was an official church function, but it was just church people getting together. Yeah. And I was like, whoa, like Colorado's crazy.
It's true.
Yeah.
So kind of back to your original question mm-hmm. of having to kind of break off a friendship. I had something a few months ago happen with a friend. We'd been friends for a long time and we don't live near each other anymore. So it was just a technology friendship, keeping up over the phone, email, whatever. And just some things happened and I knew it was time to start to separate the friendship. And I didn't even know where to start. Like, do you tell the person it's time to end the friendship now. Because you don't really want to end it necessarily if you still want to be a part of their life. But it was just kind of moving them out of my inner circle, I think. So it wasn't, I guess I shouldn't say ending the friendship, but allowing them to take a step back. And I think it's something that was easier than I thought it was going to be. It was just like, don't call them as much. Maybe don't tell them as much personal information, because some of that stuff was coming back to hurt me in the end. And so sometimes it's just like intentional decisions to make. You know, maybe I won't call them this Saturday. I'll just text them and ask them how they are, if you want to, you know, keep a pulse check on their life and stay friends. But I think sometimes it's smart to move somebody out of the inner circle if they're hurting you or causing you to stumble in any
way. Did your friend notice at all? Like, was there any kind of like, hey, what's going on?
Yeah, a little bit. And it was just like, you know what, I'm really trying to make new friends and need to intentionally start spending time with some new people who live near me that I can build a relationship with. And it was never like a, hey, I'm doing this because I don't want to be your friend anymore. So maybe I should have been more clear about that. But also having a good conversation about, these are the things that were wrong with our friendship. So I guess we did kind of talk about that and ways to move towards a healthier friendship, because I think it was unhealthy with how much maybe we were communicating.
Yeah. I think for me, it's come to, I remember one situation where, I definitely am a big fan of, you know, iron sharpening iron, and certainly having that accountability type relationship, confronting, being confronted. But you need to assess whether or not that person and yourself are receptive to that. So if I have friends that are just, you know, I will point something out or I will attempt to grow along with them or whatever, and they just completely resist any kind of growth or whatever, then I'm kind of like, you know, that's where I'm kind of like, I don't know, maybe I just give them like a waiting period and then they're just done. But I mean, there are just some that they want to persistently complain. They want to wallow in their issues. They don't want to see gospel transformation in their life. They don't want to, you know, grow or be sanctified or whatever. And then it really does come to a point of, and I thought of that in conjunction with, I was telling Martha after a trip to a college recently, a couple girls in a Q&A I was doing asked that about one of their roommates. And she was very much a gossiper, and they were both prone to gossip too. And they noticed that they did it a lot more when she was around, and they tried to talk to her about it. And, you know, she's a believer. And if you're dealing with a believer and she's not even receptive to instruction or rebuke in that sense, then, you know, really it is, you have to remove yourself from that situation and just say, and it's not that God can't reach her at some point or other people can be her friends, but you know, you got to kind of take care of yourself too, I think, a little bit. So,
yeah. And I think sometimes in those situations, we can take a step back without like cutting ties.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, and like to say, you know, I'm going to have to, you know, we're going to have to talk less or I don't know. I mean, I think guys do that without even talking about it or thinking about it. Like we never really define relationships. They just ebb and flow. And we're like, what just happened? I don't know. And I mean, not that I'm not trying to set up guys as baboons, but I think sometimes relationally guys aren't perceptive to what's happening. Like girls are very perceptive of here's how our relationship just shifted a little bit, and guys are like, wait, what happened? Like I was just thinking we should get some wings, you know? And so anyway,
that's a good point.
But yeah, and I think another thing to keep in mind is if one of our friends is in Christ, that is an eternal friend. Like that's somebody who's gonna be in loving community with forever. And so even as we take a step back from somebody, that we still care about them and love them. There's been a lot of times where I've had to have a tough conversation with a friend where I knew, man, like the friend could dissolve after this, you know, like this is going to be a hard conversation to have. And yet prayerfully going in that, like, Lord, let me help you have your heart for them. Like, help me to get to a place where I'm really loving them and it's not an emotional reaction. Because I think sometimes we can Christianize kind of when we're really upset, we've been hurt and we're like, you know, I think this friendship has to go. And it's really, I've been hurt here. And I'm angry, and so I'm going to kind of passive aggressively end the friendship, and it's kind of like, and it makes me feel better, but really, like I should have sought reconciliation there. So I think that's kind of a place we have to think too, is, am I reacting to something that's happened, or is this, you know, is this really a, I love them, I care for them, I'm going to miss them, but this is the best thing, you know, I feel the Lord leading me in that direction.
Well, I think the flip side of that is totally true as well. Like Martha brought up that idea of, I am not going to choose to invest in you or open up to you because I fear that you're going to leave, you know? And I think, you know, where do you guys feel like, you know, ultimately we have to trust the Lord. We have to get our identity from Him. We have to find our source of, you know, true relationship from Him. We have to be secure in who we are so that we can then give and receive from other people. But it can become a very, almost an idolatrous thing where, you know, you've put this person on a pedestal, and if they don't meet your needs, if they don't, you know, if you feel like, oh my goodness, they're starting to hang out with that person and they're doing, you know, then it can become very, all of a sudden you just have a tally sheet of how this person relates to you. And I don't know mm-hmm. if, I mean, that could be unhealthy too. So mm-hmm.
yeah, we were just talking about that, because I think I used to find my identity a lot in who my friends were, you know, who was mm-hmm. calling me and asking me to do stuff. And like you said, if they don't call and they call somebody else, and now with Facebook, it's like, oh, I had so much fun with you last night. Let's do it again. It's like, wait, what did you do?
Nobody called me. Yeah.
What? And it used to just
remember
make
that's
me
Martha,
anxious.
Because she's going to invite us to our party.
Yeah,
our
parties. Yeah, that's right.
Don't check her Facebook page.
I always see Martha's parties and I'm like, woe is me.
Don't check her page. She's crafting with other people, let me tell you.
It's not Scrabble.
It's Scrabble. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But you know, it can really... Yeah, it would make me anxious, or like I'd get wrapped up in, oh, why didn't they invite me? I need to call her today and see how she's doing, and maybe so that next time she'll invite me to whatever. And really just coming to the end of myself and being like, Lord, no. Like, I find my identity in You. And I think really when I start to understand that and grasp that, you know, we find our true selves in who He is, that I define myself a lot less than who my friends were. And really just... yeah, not caring as much about that kind of stuff, because really if I'm being myself, then my true friends will want to spend time with me. And if they don't, then maybe I don't need to be friends with them. Mm-hmm. Sounds kind of
That's
mean.
Really wise advice. Mm-hmm. I do think that as we think about friendship, the people that are really good friends with Christ will mm-hmm. make good friends to other people. Like, people will mm-hmm. seek us out. And I think there are times where, like, I've noticed that, like, if you think about your life as a balance of with people, not with people, you know, and I know that being an extrovert and introvert plays into that as well. But I think there's been times in my life where I'm spending too much time alone or spending too much time with other people, and it kind of, my life gets out of balance. And so I think that some of that time alone, we need to cultivate that friendship with Christ, and it actually makes our time with other people, you know, sweeter and better. And so there's been times where I'm like, man, I just feel like some of my friendships are going sour. And really what was happening was I was spending too much time with them, and I needed to make sure that I was, you know, spending enough time with the Lord. And so sometimes that can play into the kind of ebb and flow in that as well. And learning how to do that is tough. Like, how do I pursue friendship with God? And I don't know. That's another podcast. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's good. And I think it's a good place for all of us to kind of have a reckoning of sorts, you know, for us to evaluate our friendships. Who are our friends? Could we name them? Do we know? I mean, are they just like friends in our heads?
Oh, no.
I mean, are there ones that, you know, that we're considering our friends, but maybe we are clinging to too tightly, and ones that need to be mm-hmm. let go for whatever reason? And is there someone that really, you know, maybe has been pursuing us, or someone that God's put on our heart that we should start pursuing for some level of friendship? I mean, I think that there's always room. I like that idea of, you know, your heart is not finite. You know, you can invite other people in and create space for them. Your time is finite, though. Mm-hmm. So you have to mm-hmm. really be wise in that and give yourself margin, give yourself time for the Lord, certainly in a way that is measurable, far beyond, you know, what we're doing in other things, as Andrew said. So let's all do that this week. And, you know, weigh in on the blog. Let us know what you think about this topic. If this is something that resonated, if it's something that was kind of a little wake-up call for you, like, whoa, I need to evaluate my friendships, and let us know what you think. So thanks, you guys. When He moves, you got to move. You know, you got to lose control. Let go. There's nothing left to hold on to. This life you live is really not your own. So where He goes, you go. You know, He leads and you follow. He moves, you move. He moves, you move. He moves, you move. When He moves, you move. Well, hello, everyone. I'm very pleased to have you back for this week's culture segment for another interview. And you know that here at The Boundless Show, we love to interview authors when we find them and they are writing about and speaking about great topics that apply to all of us. And this one is no exception. I have got Elizabeth Brown on the phone. Hi, Elizabeth.
How are you today?
I am doing pretty well, although you can tell from my voice I'm a little bit sick. But I knew that this was an important enough interview that we had to get it done. So here we are. You are the author of Working Successfully with Screwed Up People, which is what we're going to talk about today. And you're actually the author of a few books similar to this topic, as well as dealing with loss. I think you have one related to that as well. So we're just so pleased to have you here. And I think you're going to have a lot to share with our audience. We're excited about that. So let me just start by saying I really like the way that you kind of lead out the book by suggesting or really asserting that it only takes one person to change a relationship. And that's probably a little counterintuitive for some people. So I would love for you to kind of unpack that for us a little bit, Elizabeth, because as we apply this now to the workplace, I think that'll be interesting. So how can we change a relationship just by one person making the effort?
Well, literally, one person is all it takes to change a relationship, because if you change and you are no longer reacting the same way, the other person has to change what they do in order to get the response they want. So especially when we're dealing in difficult situations, oftentimes we try to come back, and the person is getting just exactly what he wants. He's getting the response, and he's showing who has the power. Take that out of the equation, and you have so much more control in what you do.
Absolutely. Let's back up here for a minute and just talk about some things, because I know you have a lot of experience, not only yourself, but working with people who are in many different working situations. What would you say are some just good examples of things in the workplace that generally cause tension? I mean, obviously, if we all just worked on our own and made all the decisions and had our way every time, you wouldn't have had to write this book. But what would you say are some of the biggest friction causers?
Well, the first thing is that naturally, we think what we are doing is the right way.
Mm-hmm.
It's our natural response. If we think this, then that's the way it should be. And when we get into the workforce, many times you'll find only maybe one person in the whole company will think the way you do. And that's the success of a successful company, is that they have lots of different temperaments in there so that they can circle the wagons of all the business problems, so people look at everything from different viewpoints. So here you have the need for business to have all these different viewpoints, and the natural propensity of all of us to think that we've got the right answer. And you put those things together, and there is tension. Tension in lots of issues, just as simple as, what do you call your boss? Do you call him Mr. or do you call him Joe?
Mm-hmm.
That may not be difficult for a person who's 50 or 60 to figure out, but when you're 24 and entering the workforce, you don't know.
Sure. So one thing that I think is so fascinating, of course, you know, and everyone wrestles with this in some sense, you know, say, let's take a specific example of, you know, there's something that has cropped up at work, and it is, you see it as a source of, it's going to be a problem. How in the world do you determine from the get-go who the problem is? Is it you or is it them? Now, I know for me, Elizabeth, it's never me. It's always the other person, okay? So, but I mean, for the others out there that, you know, it may be, maybe them. How can you determine in this situation whether or not you, in fact, are the source of the problem?
Well, you have to put your glasses on, literally.
You have
to look at the situation as if you're above it and looking down, and how hard that is. But it's crucial, because unfortunately or fortunately, the way we grow up is by learning to deal with all these differences. And you have to be able to see. Sometimes you're really working with someone who's telling you to do something that you know is just not going to be the right way. But if they have the power and they're in control, then it boils down to the fact of, you want this job or not. If you want it, you have to do it their way. And that can really be difficult if you're so sure you're right. So sometimes being quiet is the way to handle these situations and let it prove itself out. State what you think, what you believe to be the case, and then if it proves that the other case is wrong, you will have won a point. If you argue, though, you just put up barriers.
Right. So really, in thinking about this, it gets me to thinking about a biblical response to any kind of conflict. And it makes me wonder, you know, a lot of my friends that I talk to, they kind of wrestle with when do you have to, in the workplace, just let something go? Like, when is it something that maybe you're making too much of it? And it's really like, you know, okay, Lisa, simmer down, just let it go. It's not that big of a deal. Or when does it cross into just outright avoidance of an issue, something that doesn't, you know, that can't be avoided? How do you differentiate between those two?
Well, we all know what is right and what is wrong. If it's unethical, it's unethical. Someone's stealing, you can't just be quiet. You have to report that or you become an accomplice to it. Bottom line is, we all struggle with these issues, and we have to stand back, look at it carefully, appraise whether it's worth the battle. Some things, just like working with a young child, it's not worth the battle. And so save your precious times for confrontation to things that really will make a difference in the long run, really will make a difference.
Sure. Okay. What about a situation, Elizabeth, where you feel like it's not just between you and another person, but there's, or maybe the initial thing is with you and someone else, but you've maybe tried to bring it to them or to their boss, or you just feel like the situation in the workplace, the structure is broken. Like, I've had friends who've tried to address things that they knew were wrong, maybe with their supervisors, with their HR department, and it's gotten brushed under the rug, or it's gotten, and I think a lot of young adults have this feeling of powerlessness. Like, they're young, they're just being told what to do, and there really is, they feel powerless to effect change. Is there any recourse for them in that?
Well, they're dealing with reality. In any workplace, there is a structure, and the structure limits what you can and cannot do, and it takes time to build relationships that give you the opportunity to make a difference. If you're the bell ringer, if you're always looking at things and finding the problem with it and constantly in conflict, you'll not be heard. And so you have to pull yourself back out of that and look at it, and here again, it's still what you aren't powerless, but you are powerless in some ways until you develop enough relationship that people trust you. When a man goes into, or a woman goes into a new job, the first thing to do is nothing. Now, that is counter to what we as young people think. We think, you know, we've got all these skills, we've been hired for the job, so obviously we're needed, so they want our input. And but until you get the trust factor in there, your input will be not of value. Once you begin to establish that you're reliable as a person and in a relationship, and those are things that take time, then your voice will be heard and not before.
Okay. So specifically then, I mean, that of course begs the question, what if that problem really is with your boss or your supervisor? You know, this is going to be the situation many in our audience are in, and they've just got really maybe a terrible boss, and there's no there's no way for them to get around that. What would be, you know, how can they change things when it's really the boss or supervisor who's causing the problem?
And oftentimes it is the boss or the supervisor, and you're feeling very controlled. So you need to get a reality check. Do you want the job? Is the job worth what you're having to put up with? You probably are not going to change the personality of the person. But this book addresses temperament. You must recognize what can change and what will never change. So if you look at the situation and you say, gee, this person calls for all morning conferences, and I'm a night person. You better figure out a way to get alert in the morning, and that may mean an extra Starbucks. And that's such a simple one, but it's not so simple when you have a boss who is a rule follower and you think these rules are just stupid. I mean, what company would be much more efficient without such rules and structure? So there's a chapter in the book about the company life. Companies have life ages just like people have life ages. And if you're in a company and you like to be flexible and share your ideas, then you need to be in a company that's a startup company, not a company that's been in business forever. Because the longer a company has been in business, the more established rules there are. And recognizing the age of the company may help you recognize whether you're in the right environment for your personality, for the gifts that God has given to you.
Yeah, that makes sense. And it's kind of another one of those things where it's hard to weigh, you know, what's the right decision? Because I think, you know, I often harp on young adults, the ones that are younger than I, in saying, you know, you need to get into a job and you need to know what it means to work hard and to kind of earn your stripes. I think some of our generation has lost that, you know, from the previous generations of they just want work to be fun. They want it to be easy. They want to create their own hours. And it's like, no, you know, your first job, you probably are going to be making some copies and getting coffee and whatever. So I think there's an element of that. But then, like you're saying, also look maybe ahead to how do your personality traits and your temperament and all that, how does that fit kind of where ultimately you want to fit in as a niche? Would you say that's a good way of kind of keeping a balance to that?
Absolutely. Or? Absolutely. Two of the strongest points of this book is the list of temperaments, the things in us that will never change. And when you see that, behavior is not that issue. It's not right, no matter what your temperament is, to misbehave, to be rude or bad. But at the same time, the way you look at the world is shaped by your temperament. So you need to understand that. You need to understand the life of the company so that you see whether this really is a fit. Am I the problem, or is it that I'm really in the wrong stage of this business's life? Those are the analytical things that require us to look at it so that we're not constantly thinking we're a failure. Maybe we're just not in the right niche.
Okay. So taking all of this into account, Elizabeth, you know, say a person really has tried to stick it out and they've tried to evaluate the temperaments around them. They've tried to deal with their own stress in the situation. They've really tried to maybe openly and biblically resolve a very real conflict that may be there. When can a person decide if really it is time for them to leave a job, and how can they come to that conclusion?
Well, there are times to leave a job. A lot of us feel like it's a failure to leave, but sometimes it's the courageous act to leave a job. When your job feels like work, you might want to be thinking about whether you're in the right place. And by saying that, there is no such thing as a perfect job. But you can stay in the worst kind of jobs if you know that what you're doing is making a difference. You can stay with total nerds of personality if you know that maybe what you're doing, you're being positive and optimistic and being encouraging to others, that you're there to make a difference in the whole culture of the business. So sometimes we go in thinking, you know, the business ought to make us feel good, when maybe we're where God put us because we can make the difference.
Mm-hmm. Would you say, speaking of making a difference, and I know you talk a little bit in the book about, you know, addressing just those general office politics, and that can run from, you know, gender wars to kind of the tenor of the office and kind of how people talk, the water cooler talk. For a believer in the workplace, how should a believer know what to put up with? Because, you know, some will say, oh, you're a light there. You need to stick it out. You need to be a witness. You need to, and other people will say, you know, this is probably isn't very healthy and you probably need to get out of there. What's a good way to manage that?
Well, those are the iffy questions, aren't they? Wouldn't mm-hmm. we like to live in a world where everybody was perfect and we could share our faith openly? But the best way to share faith is by your actions. If you're caring and forgiving and don't hold grudges and don't become part of the gossip chain, if you say positive things, you will share your faith because people will begin to look to you. They'll see you as someone that they don't label as a backstabber, as somebody who's just in it for themselves. And that's the real expression of faith. So the best way to share at work is to live it. It speaks louder than words. No one wants to work with someone who's preaching or constantly complaining, but it's a rare bird who doesn't appreciate someone who's slow to anger, who's caring, appreciative, responsible. All of those things say that I believe in you, you're going to do well, and we're in here as a team.
Well, that's great. Elizabeth, any other advice for young adults, especially those 20-somethings, early 30-somethings who are trying to navigate the workplace that you've gleaned from your own experience?
Well, I will say this, that people need to relax. In this generation, it's not going to be unusual for each of them to have three different careers, not jobs, careers. So don't get too uptight about where you are. See what you can do, what you can learn, how you can enjoy it, and what you can share of you with the company. You're going to carry that into the next job or the next job with you. All those things will compile, and as you go along, if you've made good relationships, you'll find that network builds and creates the impetus for the next positions you might hold or the next opportunities. So sometimes it's seeing our difficult workplace opportunity as opposed to terrible challenge.
Sure. And I guess that's true, because as I think of it now, I'm kind of in my third career, and I really see those first two as having given me some great experience and different experience that built into what I'm doing now. And, you know, I never would have thought 15 years ago that I'd be doing what I'm doing now, you know, never would have predicted it. But I see how those building blocks really contributed to that. So that's good wisdom. So, well, Elizabeth, thank you so much for weighing in on this. Again, everyone, she is the author of Working Successfully with Screwed Up People, and that's what we've been talking about today. Thank you so much, Elizabeth, for your time, and we will let folks know how to, you know, the information on how to get the book. There's more in here that we didn't even touch, so a great, really, primer for people to get into this and understand how to navigate where they work, because that's a big chunk of our days. I think people underestimate, you know, how much time we spend at work and the impact that it can have on us and on others. So thank you so much.
Oh, Ed, wonderful to be with you. Have a great day. And please, if burn away the darkness, his love is like a furnace where the fire never slays.
We are opening up this week's inbox, and I have Candace Waters on the phone. Hey, Candace.
Hi, Lisa. Great to hear your voice, as always.
Thank you. Well, it is great to always be on the phone with you and gain your insight for these inbox questions, which we are going to address right now. So I'm going to read this one, and it's kind of a long question, so I might summarize a little bit of it, but then let you take a stab at it.
Okay.
All right.
Good.
Here we go. This listener says, I'm in my late 20s and I've never dated. I'm trusting that God has someone special for me and that he will bring us together in his perfect time. I also understand that I can't just sit around at home waiting for that person to show up at my doorstep. And then in her next paragraph, she talks about all the things that she's done. She's gone to Bible college, university. She's been in campus groups, traveled on missions trips, and goes to a solid church and used her friends and family. And she finally says, where is the line between actively looking for someone and patiently waiting? Sometimes I get discouraged when I think of all the things I mentioned and how I haven't met my future spouse yet.
I can definitely understand the discouragement. She really has done, it sounds like, everything in her power. And that's a good thing. We've talked before on the show and on Boundless about God working through means. He works through churches. He works through friends. He works for some people through online matching services. You know, he works for some people through Boundless.org. But we can't force God's hand and conform his timeline into our timeline. And I think this is where it would be good for her to spend some time meditating on 1 Thessalonians 4:3 that says that the will of God for you is your sanctification. And that really the ultimate goal for her isn't marriage, but becoming more like Christ. And where she says, I'm trusting God for this person, I would just say continue to trust him and ask him to help you trust him as you wait, because there may be a really long delay, or it's even possible that you won't get married. And So the challenge is to wrestle with that and get to the point where you trust God enough to say, even if I don't get married, even if I don't get the one thing I want more than anything else, I trust you enough and I believe that your plans are good, that if that happens, I will be okay because you will be there with me. You will be there in your grace and in your goodness helping me. And that if it will give you more glory for me to stay single, then I want to stay single. I think that is the heart attitude that we should strive for, whatever it is we're waiting for. You know, it's not just single people hoping for marriage that need to hear this word. And I think it is a hard word, but I think it's a necessary, truthful word because it comes from Scripture. And for the married woman who wants a baby who isn't conceiving, or for the mother who has a baby with Down syndrome, or for, you know, the parent who has a prodigal child who's waiting for them to come home, we're all waiting for something. And that's just a reminder that we live in a Genesis 3 fallen world that is marked so evidently by sin and by the fall. And so wait on the Lord more than anything. You know, let him renew your strength, as Isaiah says, so that you can mount up on wings as eagles. And again, I know this isn't a fun word, but we don't serve a God who says, if you do good, I'll give you good. That's not a promise that God makes in the Bible. Mm-hmm. He says, trust in me, delight in me, and I will give you the desires of your heart. I think in America, we tend to camp out on the desires of our heart part of that verse, and we need to spend time camping out on the delight yourself in the Lord part, because the more we delight in him, the more we're able to trust that his plan, whatever it is good, even when that plan doesn't match what we wanted it to.
Yeah, that's a good point, Candace. And I mean, it's as I think of it, I mean, that's exactly where I am as well. And I'd like to encourage this listener. I mean, I'm 41 and still single and feel like I've done many things as well. And, you know, I get a lot of people saying, well, are you sure you've done enough? Or are you sure you're not too picky? And a lot of that. And
yeah.
I'd like to just remind her, too, that God is not to trust God to walk with you through this as well. I mean, because I've had seasons where it's been a lot more sadness and a lot more feelings of loss and stuff. But at the same time, I've seen God really meet me in my singleness and in my desire for marriage to, you know, I don't think God's sitting there saying, the one thing I need to do is make sure that Lisa's life is terrible so that she can be sanctified, or that she can, you know, God doesn't need to put his thumb on us and make us have a horrible life so that we're, you know, submissive or humble or whatever. I mean, God can accomplish that in other ways. So I want to encourage her just to, like you said, as she puts her trust in the Lord and as she looks to, you know, the blessings in her life and what God's doing through this and the joy that she has, the things that she can do, to know that God will meet her. And, I, you know, I'm in a season kind of right now where I'm feeling very good about where I am in life. I've had some where I haven't, you know, and you know, sometimes when that next best friend gets married, that's a sting and that's tough, but I work through that. And then God brings me back and says, Lisa, look where I have you. And so, you know, it's an up and down, but in all of it, you know, trusting God shows that he really is, has our best interests at heart and he wants our good. So,
yeah.
I would just remind her of that.
That's a great word. And, I really appreciate, Lisa, your candor and, you know, your vulnerability to say, hey, I've been there in this way, and this is what I'm waiting on. And I know, you know, once I got married, there were new things to wait for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know?
Exactly.
So, and I don't know anyone who's not waiting on something. And really, we're all supposed to be waiting on Christ's return and waiting for heaven. And that hope is really what should animate us more than anything.
Very true. Well, good thoughts, Candace. Thanks for weighing in on that and giving her some hope and some good advice for this season of her life. And again, I think both of us will acknowledge that, yeah, she's done a lot of good things and she's doing those things. And, you know, trusting in the Lord is what she needs to do now, and just trust him to complete what he's got for her. So,
yeah.
All right. Well, that is it for this week's show, everyone. Write to us with your question for a future show at editor@boundless.org. Hopefully you are enjoying our new site and that you've kind of poked around on it a bit and signed up, joined our community to comment on the blog. Please do give us your feedback on that as well when you write in. So we will see you around next week for The Boundless Show. I'm your host, Lisa Anderson. See you soon.
The Boundless Show is a production of boundless.org. Focus on the family.
A donor-supported ministry of Focus on the Family.